Oh, how nice. Thank you. You didn't even know I'd come with that ready, did you?
I thought I would introduce our speaker by reading a couple of sentences which I think describe what political leadership is all about and what a political president is about. The title of perhaps her best known but not her most recent book. And the sentence reads as follows. Having asked, is the political president an inner-directed or an outer-directed person? She says, the political president is an amalgam, other-directed in manners, but with a strong conviction and sense of direction that characterizes the inner-directed type. And then she goes on to make a connection with particularly President Johnson and President Reagan. Barbara Kellerman is certainly one of the most productive of our scholars writing on the presidency. This book, The Political Presidency, has been widely reviewed and hailed as a major work in the field. So has the book, All the President's Kin, and that's the subject that we hoped she will examine with us this afternoon. She also is co-author of the book Making Decisions and editor of Leadership Multidisciplinary Perspectives. She's Dean of Graduate Studies and Research at Fairleigh Dickinson University and also Professor of Political Science there. She's held Fulbrights at the University of Bonn in Germany and Hebrew University and several other places, I believe. She is the editor of a series on leadership for the State University of New York Press and a member of the Governing Council of the International Society for Political Psychology. I could go on in this way, but that isn't why you're here.
I'd like them to keep on listening. You know, since I'm having a fine time. Keep going.
We also ought to say that this whole area that we're exploring, presidents' families and first ladies, is something that we've undertaken at the suggestion of one of our colleagues who is here today, Felicia Warburg-Rogan. So we're very pleased that we could all be together and enter into this discussion and dialogue with you.
Thank you, Dr. Thompson, and thank you for coming on what I gather is a rather chilly March day, although coming from New York it feels positively balmy to me. I am going to talk to you about a book that, although it's the first book I ever wrote, and the book came out in 1980, meaning a decade ago, it remains really particularly dear to my heart, and I will try to explain a little bit of the background. The book, as Dr. Thompson said, is called All the President's Kin. I started work on this book during my first job, which was as assistant professor at Tufts University. I had gone to all the right schools. I had all the right credentials, including a PhD, an MA, and an MPhil from Yale University. And I decided to look at something that people had previously not looked at, and indeed not taken seriously from a scholarly perspective. I don't mean that no historian ever wrote about a first lady. or that no political scientist ever looked at how important a presidential brother could be. But by and large, political science had excluded the possibility that members of presidents' families could be powerful political players in their own right. As far as I was concerned, then and even now, there are two primary reasons for this. And I might add, this book is more of a success today than it was 10 years ago. I think it's no accident that Dr. Thompson didn't invite me down here to talk about this book in 1980, but is in 1990 because times are changing in important ways. The two main reasons that I believed then and believe now the president's family was trivialized are, one, the kinds of research that I had to do this book, which is a scholarly book, this is a serious book, was in sources that are not typically considered scholarly sources. Do you think of the Ladies' Home Journal or McCall's Magazine as scholarly sources? Would you believe that's where I had to go for some information and a fair percentage of it on what members of presidents' families actually did? Now, when you use sources like that in social science and in academic circles, it is somewhat frowned on. The other reason is that, by definition, a fair number of members of presidents' families, especially since every president to date has been a man, a fair number of relatives are going to be women. By and large, presidents' mothers tend to be women. By and large, presidents' wives tend to be women. And by and large, sisters and daughters tend to be women. So as a combination of cultural norms and where some of the materials were found, this was not really an okay thing to do. And I have never really felt that political science has taken members of politicians' families, but particularly presidents' families, as seriously as they might. Now, what I am going to say then has to be understood with this as a backdrop, which is that as I am describing, and I'm not confining my presentation to you to first ladies by a long shot, more often than not, they're the most important players. But as we will see, other members of presidents' families have been extremely important players as well, important to the presidency, important to American politics specifically. And so I'm really going to talk about the family as a system, and the subtext is that this is not a joke. This is not just Ladies' Home Journal material. This is an important phenomenon in American politics and deserves to be taken seriously. By seriously, I don't mean we can't kid around about it, and indeed the title of this book is something of a play on words. But it is a serious political phenomenon that deserves to be taken with appropriate seriousness. And so that's the subtext of what I'm saying. Four sub-comments. One, virtually, did it just get darker in here? Or is it the sun receding? Powerful sun. Okay. It's not nothing symbolic, but God is trying to tell me he doesn't agree or something. Okay. Four prologue statements. One, virtually all close relatives of the president place one or another kind of political role. Two, the way these roles are played are various, as we will see when we're talking about them. They're not the same. Different people have different roles, and I'll say more about that in a moment. The reason members of the president's family play political parts is because there are two constituencies in particular who are served, or three, depending on how you count. One is, by and large, and there are exceptions, I call them skeletons in the closet, by and large, members of presidents' families help the president in various ways, and so it is to the president's advantage to have family members play certain political roles. By and large, the public benefits. We do not have a king and a queen in this country. We generally look to the first family as our emblem of what America stands for. The first lady is often very high on the list of the most popular women and so forth and so on. So the public gets some kind of secondary gain. And I hardly have to tell you that the media profits. The media indeed thrives on stories about presidential families. To this day, I, even though I've done 9 books since this one, I probably get called more about what I have to say about Barbara Bush's Graves' disease than any of the other, quote, more serious things that I've done since then. So finally, I guess what I'm trying to say is that particularly in recent years, the president's family is a permanent part of presidential government. Now, some of you in this room, as I'm looking around, I'm sure you will not take offense if I say that I can tell some of you have been around perhaps even a little longer than I. And you will remember then that presidents' families have not been as visible always as they are now. I, in fact, draw the line of public families and private families with the presidency of John Kennedy. First of all, Kennedy had, as we all know, the Kennedys are a stunningly attractive family to which we seem, in which we seem to this day to be endlessly interested. And second of all, there's the advent of television. But what I would like to read to you is a little quote that Truman wrote when he was faced with the prospect of his family going out into public, just to show you how horrified he was at the idea that his family would go out and put themselves in front of the public eye. This is a letter that Truman wrote to his sister Mary when she asked his advice about going to an Oklahoma political meeting. Truman writes, "For goodness sake, refuse the invitation. They're only using you to advertise themselves. It won't help me a bit, and it will give columnists like, you'll remember, Drew Pearson, and the rest of the gossips a chance to say that my family, particularly the women of my family, are courting the limelight. So please, don't go. Now, I don't want to appear to be in the role of a tyrant, but I know politics and political repercussions better than anyone else in the family. I have kept Bess and Margaret out of the political picture as much as I can, and I am still trying to keep them from being talked about. This sort of appearance would give all the mudslingers a chance. I have a lot of pleasant things in mind for you, if I can ever get this place, the White House, to run as it should." So you can see that it has a positively quaint ring now. I mean, it seems like it's a million years ago, but if Truman wasn't a million years ago, it was the relatively recent past. But this notion that women, whom we now are thrusting into the political limelight, should somehow stay indoors because it's unseemly or unladylike or the mudslingers would have a chance, really seems nothing if not quaint. So I am trying to indicate to you that there really was a shift in the Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy period in how we feel about family, and there are good and sound reasons for this shift. They include, one, the decline of the party. When the party declines, the cadre of loyalists whom presidents used to depend on vanishes. And as we look at our recent presidents, we see the extent to which they have used their families as this band of loyalists, as aides, as supporters, as backers, as people who go out in front of the public eye. So the decline of the party accounts in part for it. The fact that there's been such a stunning increase in the importance and number of primaries, which has meant that presidents have to use members, candidates can't be every place at once, so they send their families out to represent them. and to stand in their place during all these primary campaigns. The fact that in the last years we have personalized the presidency, we focus on the president as an individual and a person more than we ever used to. The fact that television, as I said earlier, is so terribly important. And finally, the fact that there's been a changing culture. The women, as I said earlier, the fact that we have more senior citizens. You'll recall Ms. Lillian Carter, who was Jimmy Carter's mother when we didn't know very much about Jimmy Carter. Lillian Carter was a great attraction with her lined face. As a tool of a campaign. And I'm going to just read you a little bit of an excerpt about how the Carter family, and the Carter case is a particularly interesting one because you'll recall that when Carter first announced for the presidency, not that many people knew who he was. He was a one-term governor of Georgia, and the way Carter used his family was a really was as a really powerful tool to make himself known. And let me just read you a little bit. In the summer of 1976, Time ran an article on the entire clan, the Carters, spreading like moss. It was a fairly long essay and carried nary a discouraging word about anyone. Rosalind was, quote, a comely woman with soft, almost feline movements and hazel eyes to match, whose performance as First Lady of Georgia was, quote, nearly flawless, unquote. Ms. Lillian was, quote, a redoubtable personality who would have fascinated, and I love this reference because I'm sitting in an appropriate house, who would have fascinated William Faulkner and Bertolt Brecht. The three Carter sons were all quality chips off the old block. Jack, although a law school graduate, quote, has yet to try any cases because he's too busy working for Dad. Chip, according to a Carter aide, is, quote, smart, has good instincts, and works harder than the rest. And Jeff, although shy, was dedicated and working on a degree in government and wants to be an urban planner. Amy, and I will say more, believe it or not, I will say more about Amy later. Amy, the cherished only daughter and youngest child, was, quote, a frisky, freckled, strawberry blonde who looks like Huck Finn's kid sister with the inevitable Carter smile, who basks in all the attention without letting it turn her head. Carter's three siblings were not exempt from this. They provided their earnest brother, Jimmy, with an earthy cast. Ruth Stapleton, are you remembering this cast of characters? Okay. Ruth Stapleton was, quote, the one-time high school beauty queen who has by no means lost her looks and who discovered the healing powers of Christ during a period of bleak despair in the early years of her marriage, unquote. Gloria Spahn, Jimmy's oldest sister, was, quote, the clan cut-up who enjoyed teaching art, decorating jeans with paint and decals, and roaring around on one of her two Honda motorcycles, unquote. And as for Billy, well, Billy is a very complicated story because I argue at length in this book, and I won't take you through all of this, that in the beginning, and if I can sort of have you forget for a moment what happened to Billy at the end, in the beginning, Billy was a tremendous attraction to the press. The press just loved it that this earnest Annapolis graduate had a beer-bellied, beer-drinking, gas station-owning, redneck-type brother who was, you know, I was going to say witty. Witty isn't quite the right word. Somewhat ribald, funny, always good for a quote. They would gather, as you remember, the press would gather around the gas station in Plains, Georgia, and Billy was always good for a laugh. And he got a tremendous amount of media attention. Now, I will just say about Billy that that soured, if you will recall. And Billy turned out to be really a rather grave liability for his brother. And indeed, there were articles on the op-ed page of the New York Times saying, why can't Jimmy control brother Billy, who was eventually doing rather embarrassing things like negotiating separately with the Libyan government and urinating in public at the Atlanta airport and so forth and so on. So the Billy case is an interesting case of a real presidential asset, in fact, turning into something of a considerable liability. By the way, Lyndon Johnson had a brother. Very interesting difference. I didn't really mean to talk about this, but I'm so interested in my own story that I will just say this little extra piece. Lyndon Johnson had a brother who was similarly, whom he experienced as similarly embarrassing. Now, unlike Jimmy Carter, who was a very moral fellow, whatever you think of him as a president, he is known to have high standards of ethics and morality, and who therefore obviously felt constrained from reining Billy in. Lyndon Johnson, true to form, felt no such compunctions, and in effect, and I would I lie to you, in effect locked his brother up during his presidency. He compelled his brother to live in the White House. The brother was, who is known to be something of a drinker, was under guard. There was a 24-hour guard. He was in effect a prisoner. He was his brother's prisoner. So I'm just illustrating that story because, as I said, not all presidential kin are advantageous, and I also like the story because it is, I think, very illustrative of the character of Lyndon Johnson and of Jimmy Carter. What I would point out, lest I be seen as quick to judge Lyndon Johnson, you may have heard there's this second volume out now of the Robert Caro book, which is so intensely critical of Johnson. I am not in that camp. And one might even argue that in this case, Jimmy suffered politically because of his brother's embarrassing antics. And Johnson, whatever you think of the methods, made sure that his brother did indeed not embarrass him. So I don't want my presentation of this to be seen as a facile interpretation of good and bad. Anyway, I will try to move along quickly here and take you right to what I did in this book, which is to look at, since this book came out in 80, it focused primarily on presidents between Kennedy and Reagan. And what I did was look at all the president's parents, all the president's spouses, all the president's siblings, and all the president's children. And I divided them, that is, those who were assets, who were advantageous to the president, into six roles or categories. And I will read you what the categories are, and then maybe you can start guessing who might fit into the various categories. Category one, and maybe I'll give an obvious example in each category one. For example, the first category is called decorations, and Jacqueline Kennedy, I argue in here, was an archetypical decoration. Decorations make the president more attractive. They enhance the man, make him and his administration at the most more glamorous, and at the least more appealing. They add virtually nothing to the substance of the presidency, but a great deal to the style. They lend an intangible aura of pleasure to the grit of day-to-day politics. Their presence alone lends grace. At their best, decorations are, in fact, quite removed from politics. In what would appear, but only at first glance, to be a paradox, it is this distance that allows their charm to exert its political impact. Second role, second group of relatives are, I call, extensions. The Kennedy siblings, some of them, not all of them, we'll talk more about that later, were extensions. Some of the Bush children are extensions. At various points in her father's 8-year tenure in the White House, Maureen Reagan was an extension, and I will read you my definition of extensions. Extensions are the president when the president cannot be there. They have very little identity of their own. Indeed, their value as an extension is derived not from who they are, but from what they are, a close relative of the president. What they say is only minimally important. Recognizing this, they usually say very little. When it is anything more than a pleasantry, we know it is the president who is speaking through a trusted mouthpiece. Extensions allow presidents to win friends and influence people without really trying, often without even being there. The very best extensions bear a physical resemblance to the president. They are, in effect, his stand-in. Third category is humanizer. In this category, I would put people like the early Billy Carter that I just referred to, and also Barbara Bush. Humanizers bridge the gap between the president and the people. They are particularly useful to presidents who hold themselves somewhat apart from the masses. They lend credence to the belief that if a president has a relative that is that much like the rest of us, he cannot be all knight, king, or saint. Humanizers have an air of wit or color about them. At their best, they amuse as well as reassure. Lillian Carter, I should add, I think was a fabulous humanizer. Fourth category, helpmeets. Maybe there was no better helpmeet ever to a president than Lady Bird Johnson. Helpmeets derive their function, their political function, from a good working relationship to the president. Although they are, of course, either a spouse or a blood tie, the primary interaction is based on business. They become, in effect, trusted and respected junior business partners, sharing the tasks with which the business of presidential politics must contend. The proficiency of helpmeets is respected, and their willingness to help with the presidential burden mutually understood. In the fifth category to this date, that is from Kennedy through Bush, I have been able to find only one candidate, but it was so special that I, in fact, established a category just for this one person and this particular relationship to the president. I call the category moral support, and as you hear me go through the categories, you will see that there's overlap. Obviously, a helpmeet is a moral support, and a moral support sometimes is also a decoration. But when I focus, I'm focusing on the primary function of the president, and I felt that Julie Nixon Eisenhower and her relationship to her father, particularly in the waning days of the Watergate crisis, at the height of the Watergate crisis and thereafter, that was such a special relationship. I'm not a psychoanalyst and I'm not even a trained psychologist, although I'm something of an armchair psychologist. one could argue, if you look at some of this literature pretty closely, that her support of her father, Pat, was nowhere to be found, neither publicly and from everything we know privately. Tricia, always the well-behaved and dutiful daughter, was simply not available during this period, again, certainly not publicly. As you know, Richard Nixon didn't have a whole lot of close pals and chums that he could count on. His daughter, though, who bore by this time, of course, the Eisenhower name, Julie Nixon Eisenhower, was the one person who would, I don't know if you remember these days, she would go up to a microphone, and with her husband standing by her side, he didn't say anything, but at least he was there, and he bore the Eisenhower name, she would stand up for her father. She said, my father didn't do this, my father is a good man, my father is a wonderful man. And in private, the evidence we have, again, is that she was far and away his, I use the phrase moral support, one could really say psychological support. She was there for her father when really no one else was there for him, when the world was crashing down on his head. And I think there will, you know, to anybody who reads a little bit about this, there's really no overestimating the importance of the role she played. I describe moral supports, of which I have found only one in this very special way. They have a special place in the heart of the president. They are politically relevant because they lend an essential support to the presidential ego and because they extract, in turn, an intense emotional commitment. A child cannot qualify as a moral support. To be one, it is necessary to be sufficiently intellectually mature to understand what it is the president is doing, and given that, to lend a heartfelt corroboration. And that's Julie Nixon Eisenhower. My last category is the most important in terms of the political power associated with this role is so obvious that it really doesn't particularly need elaboration. I call the category alter ego. I won't say who I put in this category. I will ask you to say when I finished reading it. Alter egos are those rarest of relatives, someone to whom we are so close on so many levels that they and we are one. The interaction is in every area. It is constant. I would claim that when a president has an alter ego, he or she is the second most powerful political person in America. And the benefit to presidents lucky enough to have an alter ego is considerable. Any candidates?
Nancy Reagan.
We got one.
Rosalind.
We got two. And I have, boy, you're too small. What am I doing here? I don't have to tell these people anything. I mean, that's it. You got it. You got exactly right. If you all didn't hear it, it was said before I could even sort of lean back. I thought, oh, well, we'll do this for a minute or two. It said it was 5 seconds. Nancy Reagan, Rosalind Carter, and Robert Kennedy. And if you look at their relationships to the presidents, I think the definition that I just read, whether or not you agree with these various divisions is not to the point right now, but the definition of them being virtually one. By the way, of course, in the case of the Kennedys, since they're both dead and were both shot, it's not an object of study, but it's interesting to watch both Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter having left office. You know, Jimmy Carter does all this negotiating now and so forth, and you hardly see a picture of him without his wife alongside. Whether he's with a head of state, whether he's with a group of students, whatever it is, she's there. And of course, Nancy and Ronald Reagan too, although that's he's much less active than Jimmy Carter. But yes, I think when you have an alter ego, that person is in effect co-president. You have the feeling that this person plays a very, very powerful advisory role that grows out of a lifetime of similar thinking. Well, I don't know if I'm supposed to go on at this point or if we should open it to questions. I have a lot more that I could say. Let me see if there's something that I feel you simply can't do without. I guess the main thing that I would leave you with is that most of these relatives are assets, although by no means are they all assets. Do I have your indulgence for a few more moments? I do. Okay. I want maybe to close, and then we can go back to some more specifics if you want. And if you want, I can certainly do more with individual people. But I'm trying to. What I'd like to do in the closing part of my more formal statement is to go back to the system. I've talked a bit about individuals, and I think really to study this you need to look at individuals. But what I also want to convey is the whole, and it's, if you look at the last two presidents, as we know, Reagan espoused family virtues a great deal, and yet so many of us who watched this were struck, and it became very, very clear as the years wore on, that this indeed was, however, the public posture notwithstanding, was a very, very fractured family, except for the couple, which were joined at the hip. With regard to their children in particular, it was a very fractured family. The Bushes, it seems, are really going back to what Americans most like to see in the White House and feel very happy with, a traditional father figure who to all appearances was certainly a quite, if not very good father, a mother who is motherly in every way, who makes no bones about it, who is a throwback to some traditional waspy New England virtues, who doesn't dye her hair and doesn't give her face a lift, and who is proud of the fact that she's not Twiggy. And the children, the daughter and the sons and the grandchildren, the Hispanic daughter-in-law and so forth. And it's that system of which the Bushes are really very representative of that I'm going to read you some excerpts about, because I think apart from the very specific political roles that kin play that I've tried to suggest is very important in campaigns and often very important in governing, there is the emblematic or symbolic quality of having family in the White House. So it's so our need is so powerful for that that Reagan invented it even when it wasn't the case. And what I just want to read you as a sort of sign of that, that I've always enjoyed, is the ritualistic description every Christmas time of the White House Christmas dinner. It's almost always exactly the same, and yet every Christmas we get it, and I'll just go through a couple of them. I think the one I'm looking at now is Johnson, Nixon, and Carter. This is the Johnson Christmas. President and Mrs. Johnson and their older daughter, Linda, 21, began their Christmas day by attending St. Barnabas Episcopal Church. Mr. Johnson gave his wife a camera. Lucy's gift to her father was a belt and a buckle. And Linda gave her parents an album of prints by Hogarth. Christmas dinner, including turkey with cornbread dressing, sweet potatoes with marshmallow on top, vegetables and fruitcake and eggnog, was served at the ranch at 6 p.m. By the way, all of these are from the Times, okay? This is like not the Ladies' Home Journal. President and Mrs. Nixon, this is of course several years later, in this case 5 years later, President and Mrs. Nixon celebrated Christmas quietly today at the White House with their family and Mrs. Dwight D. Eisenhower, who of course is also family through David. The first family opened their Christmas gifts and their red Christmas stockings, bulging with other presents in the yellow oval room of the White House. Then they gathered for a dinner that consisted of... You are really smart. Very, very, very smart. For a dinner that was early roast turkey, roast turkey dinner with Mrs. Eisenhower, their daughter and son-in-law, Julie and David Eisenhower, and their other daughter, Tricia. The president hinted that he wanted lots of books and gave away the secret that he would be giving his wife and daughters jewelry, as was his custom. The president and his family went by helicopter to Camp David late in the afternoon. 2 years after that, the Carters were in the White House. Offering prayers for peace in the Middle East, President Carter celebrated a traditional Christmas at home with his family. There was breakfast at his mother's house and Christmas dinner at his mother-in-law's. The president said that his Christmas presents included an Irish tweed jacket, a pair of binoculars, books, record albums, and two shirts. Mr. Carter then drove home, changed out of blue jeans and sweater to a dark blue suit, and drove to Bible class. Later, the president and his family returned to Mrs. Smith, that's Rosalind's mother, Mrs. Smith's home for a dinner of roast turkey with giblet gravy, cornbread dressing, candied sweet potatoes, green beans, a cheese ring, cranberry sauce, hot rolls, and fruit cake. And that's my last word for the moment.
Who would like to ask the first question, not about Christmas?
Or comment, you know. You really have experienced this as much as I, and so this is not just asking me questions. I'm really interested in your comments and reactions as well. So.
Yes, Bob Thurston.
In what category would you put that very great person, Eleanor Roosevelt?
Yeah.
Does she need a category of her own?
Well, I've been asked that, and I call her an alter ego. She, of course, did not have the same, we know now, we didn't know then, we are a lot smarter about all these things now than we were then, much more is revealed now about presidents. We know that they were not close in the same way to all appearances that some of these other presidential couples are, but of the fact that she was a politically very powerful, that she was in on major decisions, that she was, as we know, his eyes and ears in so many ways. I think to call her anything other than an alter ego is to do her a disservice. God knows she wasn't a decoration. I shouldn't say that as a strong family. She wasn't a decoration. She surely was more than an extension. She was a helpmeet, but not the way Lady Bird Johnson was, and I also talk about Joseph Kennedy as a helpmeet, that is the father of John. No, this was an alter ego who was in on the details of government in very many powerful ways. So.
Any follow-up?
These are not engraved in stone. You know, as I said, first of all, they overlap a bit, the categories. Second of all, they're not engraved in stone. I'm happy to be persuaded otherwise. But I do think they're I have found them very useful devices that, you know, that people can connect to and that I find make some kind of sense.
Would you agree?
Why do you use the term help me?
As opposed to help mate?
Yeah.
It's a quaint, older, there's no hidden agenda. If you look in the dictionary, the reason I chose help meet is because help mate sounds, it was almost always the woman that was the helpmate. And the way I'm using the term, I wanted to degenderize it as much as possible because I think a male can be a help. I mean, as I said, one in this book in detail, I describe what Joseph Kennedy did for John Kennedy's candidacy, how central he was to putting him in the White House. He was hidden because in many circles, as I know you know, he was persona non grata, and so he was very much in the background. But as much as he was in the background, so powerful a role did he play. It was simply to slightly degenderize the term that I chose, the more antiquated form of the word.
Which one of the presidential families do you think, if you took the family as a whole, best came up to what the public would expect from a perfect presidential family?
Well, it's hard to beat the Kennedys from what we knew then. You know, now it's all, that was the still Camelot. There's been so much sullying going on since then. It's hard for us to remember how relatively innocent we were then. And it was, as I said, the dawn of the age of television. Television had been around before Kennedy's, but not. Looked like his brother. He was a cute kid then. Shock of hair reminded people of his older brother, Bobby Kennedy and Ethel Kennedy and their many children. Pat Lawford, Pat Kennedy Lawford, and handsome Peter Lawford, they had kids. Gene Kennedy. There were so many of them, and it was enough of a time of innocence that I think you really, certainly in recent times, you have to go back to then. But you have to throw yourself back to that age as well, when we were, I think, really considerably more innocent, and when the press was not as intrusive a mediator between the president and the public as it has become since. I wanted to just, if I may use your question to piggyback an anecdote on, the story of Rosemary Kennedy is an interesting one. You're nodding, and therefore I'm sure you know it. I don't know how many others do. Rosemary Kennedy was a troubled daughter who, as it turns out, at Joe Kennedy's instruction, without Rose Kennedy's knowledge, underwent a lobotomy, which is a horrendous operation, not at all performed anymore. The family was too embarrassed to say, and this is, I'm talking in the 60s now, I'm not talking in the 80s. At the time of the running and the Kennedy in the White House, the family was too embarrassed to say that she was tucked away in a convent in, I think, the state of Wisconsin. And in fact, James McGregor Burns's book on Kennedy, which is James McGregor Burns is not a slouch, and all public materials on Kennedy would say one or another version of the not truth. One version was that she had cerebral palsy. Another version was that she was a nun. And only in 1962, 2 years after John Kennedy was in the White House, did Eunice Shriver come out and start in a very gingerly fashion to tell the public the truth about this sister of hers. This, of course, has since then been extended by Eunice Shriver into a very active campaign on behalf of the handicapped, and particularly the Special Olympics. I'm sorry I used your question to expand.
Tree the problem.
I know you say that your categories overlap, but just how do you distinguish between the alternate ego and the healthy?
It's a level of degree. It's only degree. In other words, my helpmeets, for example, were people like Lady Bird Johnson and Joe Kennedy. And I think Lady Bird Johnson was fabulously important to her husband. But her husband, I described a helpmeet as a junior partner. Her husband never treated, God knows he never treated Lady Bird as an equal. I think Lady Bird is a great woman, by the way. I think she is just great. Very, shouldn't say underestimated, because people who pay attention to these things, by and large, know she's great. But the American public, I think, has not fully appreciated this woman. Anyway, her husband may, in his fashion, have appreciated her, but he didn't treat her as an equal. An alter ego is an equal. It's not a junior partner, not somebody in the background. It is a full equal. And I think that's really the distinction between the junior partner and the full partner.
Is this something that does crop up, though, even in the alter ego case? The famous story about FDR and Eleanor someone asked just before one of those radio broadcasts, or television broadcasts, about the history of the relation, asked, what bothered you most? And she needed some coaxing to finally answer it. But she said, well, she guessed the thing that bothered her most was that when they had guests, or a particularly distinguished political guest, a subject would come up and Roosevelt would say, I don't know what we can do about that, and she'd make a suggestion. And his immediate reaction was, it won't work. And then a month later, they'd have another guest, and the same problem would be raised, and he would propose precisely what she had said, without giving her a single word of credit.
Yes. Well, as I said a few moments ago, when you asked the very good question, it's not, we know enough about the, this sounds like a, like my, me and my husband, you know, this, we know enough about the relationship that it isn't Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan, and it isn't the Carters either. This was a different relationship. She had her life, he had his life in many ways. But to make her less than an incredibly powerful person in the administration, I think simply isn't giving a clear picture of what she is. What you're talking about, I think, rose out of the personal part of how they related. The other thing I would say about that is, and the reason I began with this women's movement thing, is I don't think we can underestimate the importance of the shift in the culture, in the attitude towards women. Nowadays, husbands are often, not God knows, not always, compelled to dignify their wives' comments, certainly in public situations, because it's unseemly it's just not done anymore. We're talking really very different generation and very different times. Women have come a long way, baby, since those times, and I don't think that difference should be underestimated in these discussions. Yes.
Do you now think whatever would be possible for an unmarried man to come into the White House?
Don't hold your breath. I happen to think that's tough. I think, I ended with the roast turkey dinners for a reason. I think we want a family there, and everything that brings, and as I said, even when there isn't a family, as in the case of the Reagans, it was the fiction wasn't exactly, it was made up. I think it would be, this came up when Jerry Brown, the erstwhile popular governor of California, ran, and people would ask me then, and I said, I just couldn't see it. One should never say never in this world, but I think family is very important symbolically, and as I said, it's very important to presidents. These are really useful, I'm tempted to say tools. These are useful devices to send out your spouses and siblings to campaign for you or to represent you at a dinner when you can't be there. And again, also to do some of the spade work. Who was George Bush's campaign manager? His son. These are trusted and loyal aides. And when they're children, they're adorable and people smile when they walk in. So I think families are both symbolically and practically of real political consequence.
Victor Yonke and then Dr. Curran.
This is my question, just a comment you suggested. I happened to be in Washington at the time when Dwight Eisenhower gave a tremendous defense to her father, and I'm very glad you mentioned that. It made me feel really good that a daughter would do that, any child would do that. But later, when we found the truth, I thought it was a dreadful thing for the president to do. Not to be some cautionary.
You mean that you feel he lied to her?
Absolutely.
I think you're right. And I don't know, I really don't know what the relationship between that father and that daughter has been since then.
They sat together recently?
Yes. No, that was the other daughter. Interestingly, it was Tricia. You're talking about the Malcolm Forbes funeral, and that was Tricia, interestingly. One has seen, of course, very little of Nixon generally, and when he appears, he does not appear with family. Pat has been a hermit, totally reclusive, and the daughters appear rarely and certainly not with their father. You're very right in what you're saying, and I think it's very important, but that's an ex post facto comment. The point is that I was trying to make is that during the Watergate crisis, to all appearances, she believed her father and was indeed the only member of his network of personal contacts who had the guts to stand up and defend him in public. But it's a rather sad, I agree with the point you're making.
Dr. Grant.
Let me take you back a little further than you might be willing to go. You discussed the relationship between Woodrow Wilson and Ms. Wilson during his last year.
Well, it's a very interesting case, as you know, otherwise you wouldn't have asked. Woodrow Wilson was very, very happily married to his first wife, who died. And apparently he was grief-stricken when she died. He then married I was tempted to use the phrase tough cookie, which I hope is not seen as sexist. Okay. Thank you. I'm fairly warned. Named Edith Bowling Galt. And when he became ill, she was president. It's as simple as that. She controlled all access to him. Aides would come, like Colonel House, who was, of course, a very close aide, would come with papers. She would take the papers into the president, at least for a time, and then something would happen and she would come out with the papers. She was, for all practical purposes, the president. I think that episode is one of the reasons the Constitution has been changed, so that if a president is incapacitated, there are now mechanisms to prevent wives from having such, or other relatives, or indeed other close aides, from having such unelected political power. It was amazing.
Bill Wemple and then Mrs.
I was also going to go a little further back. As you can see, many of us here might. Not quite as far as Woodrow Wilson, but back in the 30s, you tend to remember a talk about Franklin Roosevelt's sons as not particularly helpful to him, to the administration, to the name of the presidency and the president. And they got into this or that thing that didn't seem quite right, using influence and so on. I was wondering if you had gone back of those times, and other than wives, think of, because I don't think of any instances of prominent close relatives who played a strong role in working with, representing, or acting for or with the president.
I have two answers for you. One's a yes and the other is a no. One's a yes and the other is a no. I am not a historian of the presidency, so I can't answer definitively about James Polk and his family. I can tell you, though, that I believe your hypothesis is wrong, and I think one can go back to the very beginning and find presidential relatives who were extremely important. The most obvious early example, because she's such a striking figure, and some of you who know, I'm going back even further, some of you who know about First Ladies know about Abigail Adams.
No, I was referring,
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, you were excluding wives. I'm sorry.
Who are...
How about John Quincy Adams? John Quincy Adams. I can't... I wish I could give you a really authoritative answer.
No, I was curious as to whether you thought of any. I cannot...
Well, I simply haven't... I felt that there was a real shift around 1960 with the Kennedy presidency for technological, that is media, television reasons, and cultural reasons, as well as changes in the political structure reasons that I talked about earlier. Is that our auditorium next door? I think a fair hypothesis would be that since for the last two to three decades, presidents' families have been more important. And I gave you a list of reasons, whether it's change in the increase in the number and importance of primaries, decline of the political party, dawn of television, women's culture. But I would be very leery of saying that that means that in the past there were none who were supportive. One would have to go back, though, and study the preceding presidents with care to come up with a definitive response. Sorry, I can't give you a better...
Did I understand you to say you have written a book subsequent to All the Presidents Kin? And if so, is it a sequel to that? And what is the title of it, and who is the publisher?
I have written very many books since then. None of them are sequels. They're all on... none of them has ever again used the Ladies' Home Journal. I really regret this. They're all, without exception, on political leadership. Some of them focus on the American presidency, but I write about political leadership very generally. I've written about women leaders in American politics. I've written about leadership and negotiation in the Middle East. I've just finished a book on the president as a world leader, leader at the international level. So I've done many books, and you don't want to hear about all of the publishers, but I have not, in fact, written a sequel to this. I find, really, maybe this is immodest of me, but I find this holds up rather well. Now, I have to, even as I'm talking here, this doesn't talk about Barbara Bush. But it's easy enough to use the model developed in this book and update it accordingly. So I have not felt a need to do a sequel to this book.
Is that book still on bookstands?
The publisher is Free Press, and there's a paperback. It's probably in the library here. You can save yourself the money.
Thank you.
Any other? Yes.
Eleanor Roosevelt gained status and power as she gained more self-confidence. Mm. In the beginning, she was shy and not politically inclined. And after he had polio, she was forced.
Right. Yes, I do. I think that's a quote from everything I know of a totally correct analysis. And one could argue that her power was not only a function of her capacities, which were obviously enormous, but of his illness. I dare say that his illness was the mechanism that allowed her to come into her own. And I think you're right about self-confidence, especially, as we said then, you know, women didn't behave, they didn't go down into mines, and they didn't speak up, and they didn't write columns and stand in for the president. But the fact that he was handicapped gave her license, as it were, cultural license to do this. And she had the inner resources to more than meet
She got guilty about it at first when she stopped.
She didn't feel guilty in the end, and she was a truly great lady, wonderfully interesting figure. That's a marriage that even though we know more about it, and it's the pictures are somewhat, if you will, not tarnished, but they're less ideal than they once were. It's only a richer story as we hear about it. Now, I contrast that. I'm sometimes asked, I was on the McNeil-Lehrer report once, and I was asked about I can't remember what the question was. The implication had to do with sexual practices. And I do think, without going into too much detail here, I do think there are differences between a marriage like the Roosevelt marriage, which wasn't, as we know, monogamous, but where the arrangement seemed to work in some fashion, you didn't have the sense that it was impinging, and John Kennedy. I do not consider myself a prude, but what John, the way John Kennedy behaved in the White House with regard to some of these character issues really raises questions for me about his character overall, above all the fact that he did some things that were particularly dumb, you know, sleeping with mobsters, girlfriends, and so forth, and I think those connections still remain to be determined. So I think the Roosevelt marriage, the more you hear about it, it's less ideal, but richly textured, and it's a, they're great, you know, just great people, both of them, I think.
Last, final question, Paul David.
I was prepared to ask the same question that Bob Biersad did at the time he did. I'm sorry he got in ahead of me. One reason that I wanted to ask it was that I couldn't quite visualize Eleanor Roosevelt as the alter ego. I was secretary of President Roosevelt's Advisory Committee on Education, followed by Associate Director of the American Youth Commission, and we were obviously heavily involved in subjects on which Eleanor and Franklin basically disagreed. And this became evident to us in various ways over a period of 5 years. And I'm sure that was not the only area in which they had fundamental disagreements that kept right on going all the way.
Yeah, I'm not sure that an alter ego has to be a mirror image.
Yeah.
We have evidence, to take the most recent example, Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan. Nancy's devotion to her husband is, unbelievable. I think all agree, so it's like amazing. But we have a lot of evidence of disagreements she had with her husband and how she used her power to get him to shift, to have happen what she wanted to have happen, even though he didn't particularly want it to happen, when it happened. So I don't think, if I gave the impression that alter egos had to see things the same way, I didn't really mean to. I just meant to say that it's an equal partnership in which there's a powerful working together to govern, to be governors, but I didn't mean to convey the impression that there has to be a meeting of the minds on all or even most issues. I think that there are disagreements among alter egos, and that's appropriate.
Well, there was never any question that she had great influence.
I think that's the only, as I said, to describe her as a junior partner, especially for that moment in time, seems to me inadequate. He relied on her so heavily. She was so visible a presence during his period in office, which was, as we know, very long, that I think to give her secondary status is to diminish it. But I'm open to argument.
Just 6 years ago, when the book The Political Presidency was published by James McGregor Burns, who has been quoted, wrote, "Penetrating in analysis, clear in focus, wise in judgment, the political presidency from the pen of a rising young leader in the study of leadership is sure to become a landmark study." Since then, this whole flood of books has come out, and there is a sequel to this book, and it is The President as World Leader. Barbara had the foresight and good judgment to, knowing that she would be working so furiously on all these publications, to marry a physician. Maybe that's something that presidents ought to think about too as they undertake their arduous tasks. But we thank you very much for
Thank you very much.